Today is Monday, June 19th. We're going to wrap up skin cancer information and cover all of the bone information today. Okay, so page 62 has some information on skin cancers. We talked in class on Wednesday of last week about general terms that describe various cancers. What term describes a cancer associated with epithelial tissues? Carcinoma. Good. So the first type at the very bottom of page 62 that I'd like to cover for you is one called basal cell carcinoma. And like the name implies, what layer of the epidermis is affected? Stratum basal, right. So what is happening with those cells in stratum basal? What activity are they doing?
Multiplying.
Yeah. So when they multiply and they make new cells, if they're growing at a really fast rate, they can produce tumors in the skin. In this picture, this uppermost region is the epidermis. All of this down below is technically the dermis, but then you're going to notice several pockets of tumor, and these are basal cell carcinomas that have grown so fast and actually pushed down into the dermis region. So yeah, that rate of mitosis should be controlled more slowly, but you can see here that they've grown some tumors in the skin. Sometimes people experience these as being a sore that just doesn't heal. You know, if it scabs over and then it rebleeds and then it scabs over and then it rebleeds and this goes on for several weeks, then people should say, okay, this is not normal for something to scab over and continually rebleed and get that checked out. This looks just like maybe a bump that has popped, you know, maybe a mosquito bite that was infected. It looks fairly, you know, innocuous. But if left untreated, you can see that it begins to spread around the face like you see there. Even one on the eyelid here. And left untreated, they get worse and they accumulate more tissue in what they are affecting. This one is on top of the head. That's a pretty huge outgrowth there of a basal cell carcinoma. So I thought you might be interested in knowing how they treat something like this. If someone is suspected of having a basal cell carcinoma and it's nothing more than a small piece of tissue that's affected, they perform what's called Mohs surgery. And in that surgery, if this is the affected piece of skin, they start making slices through the affected skin, and a pathologist will look and see if there's any cancerous cells in that slice of tissue. It's kind of like carving the bad piece out of an apple, and eventually when you get all clean sides, then we know that we've accomplished removing that cancer, and they'll stop taking tissue at that point. Now, if they happen to take a pretty big chunk of tissue out of your skin, they can go to a fairly non-seen place like behind your ear, take a piece of tissue from there, and then smack it on that area and use it to kind of patch up the hole. And so that may be a way to work around having left a gaping hole in your skin. So, yeah, we're usually taking a fairly big chunk out when we're doing these Mohs surgeries, especially trying to get clean edges. That is something that's quite common. You know, this is age-related. This is also genetically related. Seems like it tends to run in families. So if parents have basal cell carcinomas, it seems likely that kids will have them as well. So a pretty large one there, too. Let's see, I'm going to show you this one. This person's face here apparently went untreated, and I can hit the light so you can see a little easier. It not only affected the eyelids, but up into the forehead. Yeah. The next type of skin cancer is a squamous cell cancer, and this particular one is affecting the keratinocytes. So what do keratinocytes do for a living? Waterproof, yeah. Keratin waterproof the skin. So again, we're affecting the epidermis here. And these may start out as a scaly patch of skin, and it may be crusty, it may patch over and then, you know, lose some skin cells there. But you can see that these, they look like something related with old age spots. So oftentimes they have discoloration in them, and that comes from having some melanin that's tied into that squamous cell cancer. So these are ones that have been left untreated. You can see that they begin to affect large portions of the skin. Or perhaps they were difficult to treat. Okay. And then the last one here called melanoma is our most deadly skin cancer type. It is one that affects the melanocytes of the skin because they're the ones producing melanin. So what do you think is going to increase your risk for this particular type of skin cancer?
Sun exposure,
right. So I'd like to show you what happens with melanoma, and we're going to use this ABCDE rule to diagnose melanoma. We look for irregular changes in freckles or moles growing on your skin. And so instead of reading the list here, it's probably easier to look at moles that match this abnormality. So I'm just going to take you through some pictures. You know, normally moles and freckles on our skin should have a fairly regular border. That means that they're symmetrical on both sides, not asymmetrical like the one over here on the right. Along the same lines, you know, the border for this one here tends to be rather smooth. It is symmetrical, meaning left and right halves are more or less identical. The one on the right is not asymmetrical, and the border, again, is not regular. It looks like a sketchy outline there. We also look at the coloration of freckles and moles. We notice that these here are discolored. There's two different colors there. They have even been shown to be bluish in color, yellowish, green in color. So all those abnormal colors that pop up are, again, signs that point toward melanomas. In terms of diameter, you'll notice that these two look about the same size, but we need a scale there to measure them. They say that a mole or freckle that grows bigger than the size of a pencil eraser, which is about the size of the tip of your pinky finger, something that large should also be looked at. There's also a letter E, which is enlarging or evolving. So any mole or freckle that tends to be changing shape should be one that's looked at. What dermatologists have also recommended is that you look, strip down naked, look in the mirror, front and back, for the ugly ducklings. If you've got moles and freckles that more or less look like each other, that's one thing. But if you have one that is kind of off and it doesn't look like it fits with the rest of the ones in your body, those are the ones that they should have examined. So what part of the ABCDE rule does this particular freckle fit? Yeah, C for color. Yeah, you'll notice you've got a black portion and a brown portion there. Yeah. What part of the ABCDE rule does this one fit?
D.
Yeah, D for diameter.
Borders,
yeah. And it looks fairly asymmetrical, too. So these are some melanomas. They all fit the rules. They don't have regular shapes. The borders are irregular. And I did want to mention that it doesn't have to necessarily be skin exposed to the sun that can develop a melanoma. This is a penis over here. Okay, so it doesn't have to be sun exposed skin.
I thought it was a thumb.
It looks like a thumb, doesn't it? If I don't mention it, people usually think the same thing.
I thought it was a finger.
That would be different. Yeah, yeah, that does suck. Looking at something different. So, this one again fits the bill for
irregular border.
What else?
Asymmetrical.
Good. Color looks pretty uniform there. I don't know about diameter. We can't really see it. There's no scale there. We don't know if it's enlarging or not. Unfortunately, melanocytes can break off their arms. They're kind of like spiders when they sit in the epidermis of your skin. And an arm can break off and then travel elsewhere within your skin region. So you can see how these are tumors that have spread. Look at this huge one here. And they can, of course, spread and set up residence elsewhere. We would say this is no longer benign, it's malignant, meaning what?
It's spread, right.
So another one here. This one definitely fits the bill for
size.
Yeah, much bigger than a pencil eraser. And it looks like even a two-tone color, because that looks like all melanoma in there. Okay, so again, asymmetrical, right? What about the borders? Check. How about color? Yep.
Size.
Yeah.
It looks like it's about to grow
more. It looks like it is, yeah. Looks like it's got some additions around there, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
This was on the news about a year or two ago, and it was a man in Japan who had melanoma in his gums. I know we talked about Addison's disease last week, and we talked about darkening of the skin in strange spots. So they'd actually have to take a biopsy here and diagnose it for being melanocytes that have gone amok. So yeah, this is actually all melanoma. Could you imagine if they were to try to cut this off? Because that would be extremely painful and very difficult to do, since that's all part of that tissue that holds your mouth and your cheeks together.
You can get it on your toenails.
That's right. Strange places. Yeah. And this is an excised melanoma. It's been cut out of the skin, and it looks like they did what they were supposed to. They got a clean border around the bottom side of it. So, you know, 2.5 centimeters is an inch. That gives you an idea of how big this thing is. It looks like it's at least 1.5 inches, 2 inches or so approaching in size. Pretty huge. Okay, so just to tie things up here, you know, cancer can be hereditary, like I mentioned. You know, basal cell carcinoma tends to run in families. We can also experience it through exposure to the environment, and our immune system can also cause cancers too. So I took that out of the course pack. I don't have it in there, but I just wanted to mention to you there's multiple things that can lead to certain types of cancers. Now, that does wrap up this chapter. Do you have any questions on skin? Anything we covered last week? All right. Looks like we're ready to get started with bone information, and that's going to be our last chapter for the upcoming test. So if you'll flip over with me, we're going to start on page 63. I'll give you a moment to jot down these 5 functions for your skeletal system. Would y'all like to keep lights off?
Yes.
Okay. So you're probably going to be pleased to know that we don't actually do bone names and bone markings here in lecture. That's all lab stuff. What we're going to do is just kind of background information on how the skeletal system is set up and how bones grow, all that stuff that's not related to bone names and bone markings from lab. I'm going to start you off with the first function here, though, which is to provide support for the body. Imagine not having bones as a sturdy, hard internal framework. You know, how you would hold up your muscle and other tissues against gravity. So it's kind of like we would be just nothing but a pile of tissue that couldn't move without an internal framework or a skeleton. The next major job is to provide protection. So thinking back to an earlier lab that you had, what are some of the protective cavities that you've got on the front side of your body?
Thoracic cavity.
Pelvic girdle. Pelvic girdle, good. What kinds of organs are protected by your thoracic cavity?
Lungs and heart.
Lungs and heart, good. And the pelvic girdle provides some protection for those lower digestive organs, urinary, and even reproductive organs. So there is some protection on the ventral side of our body. Let's flip and look at the dorsal side for just a moment. What are the 2 cavities on the dorsal side? Good, vertebral cavity and? Yeah, cranial, good. The brain, of course, being protected there. So we do have a lot of protection that's provided by our bones, especially our central nervous system being protected in our cranium and our spinal cord being protected inside of our vertebrae. So yes, protection is another excellent function of having these bones. Movement is hard to mention without also talking about what other organ system?
Muscles,
right. So bones don't move themselves. They require muscles to pull on them, and that's how we move our bones. We use our skeletal muscles to contract and shorten and pull these bones. Let's see, storage is another big job. You know, these bones are actually hollow on the inside. I've got some real bones that we used to use in lab. We no longer have them out there. They're very brittle, and all it takes is just dropping it on a countertop, and they would fragment off. So we actually have nothing but plastic bones out there in labs right now. So what I'd like to do is send around a tibia, because you can look inside and see that it's actually entirely hollow inside, and it's surrounded by a bunch of spongy tissue, so you can feel how needle-like that spongy tissue is. What do you think is stored in the hollow cavity inside this bone?
Bone marrow.
Bone marrow, good. And what type of connective tissue makes up bone marrow?
Loose
adipose. Loose adipose, yeah. And it's that's where we make red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets. So that's one type of storage that we do here with our bones. What about the bone tissue itself? What is stored there?
Calcium.
Calcium, yes. So calcium is another good thing to store in our bones. So we often forget that inside we have adipose tissue. It's not really meant to store energy in most places. In most places, it's meant to store or provide a site for bone marrow for red blood cell production. If it in fact is yellow marrow, then yeah, we would say it's for fat storage, but otherwise we look at this being a place for making blood cells, yeah. So hematopoiesis, fancy word there, is the name that implies blood cell formation. That's how you make red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets in the bone marrow of our bones. Okay, so I'll send this thing around to you guys to feel. And let's take a look at the bottom of the page. We're going to talk now about various shapes of bones. And I'll give you a moment to jot down these six shapes. So I'm hoping this is not a list that you really have to spend some time memorizing. This should be pretty much a self-explanatory list. These shapes of bones are named and described after their shape. So how easy is that, right? We're going to start off with the long bones, which are, of course, longer than they are wide. And our appendicular skeleton has great examples of long bones. Let's start with the hand. What about the long bones that make your fingers? They're called phalanges. Good. How about the long bones that make up the palm of your hand?
Metacarpals.
Good. Let's see. In anatomical position, the bone that is on the thumb side is?
Radius.
Good. And on the pinky side?
Ulna.
Good. And this arm bone here?
Humerus.
Good. Turning our attention toward the leg. Okay. Let's see. We've got, once again, phalanges for toes. What about the long bones that make up this portion of your foot?
Metatarsals.
Good. In this lower leg portion, we actually have a rather heavy bone known as?
Tibia.
And its tiny neighbor?
Fibula.
Which one's lateral?
Fibula.
Good. And the longest bone in the body up here known as?
Femur.
Good. All these are great examples of long bones. They are longer than they are wide. The next category, of course, are your short bones, and in your hand, technically in your wrist area, what are these eight tiny bones called?
Carpals.
And in the feet?
Carpals.
Do you know a good way to keep it straight?
Put your jaw in here. Carpals.
Good.
And then the carpals of your toes.
T for T. That's good. That's another way to think of it. Good. Okay. Let's see, we've got flat bones next, and I wanted to show you that they're built kind of like a sandwich. They have a double layer on the outside, like pieces of bread, made up of compact bones, so it's rather smooth to the touch. And if you were to break a flat bone open and look inside, that's where the meat of the sandwich would be, and that, in fact, is spongy bone on the inside. I also want to show you this picture because it's not truly flat like a book, it's somewhat curved. So all of our flat bones have a curve to them. That includes our rib bones, What else in this neighborhood is also flat?
Sternum.
Sternum, good. Any others in the body that are flat?
The cranium.
Good, yeah. These cranial bones, like parietal, occipital bones, those are great examples of curved, flat bones. I know they should have probably come up with a different name for it, right? It's not truly flat like a book. Our next one is an irregular category, and this is kind of like the, we don't know what to do with these, just jump them in an irregular grouping. So vertebrae definitely fit in here. What else would you put in this irregular category?
Bones of the pelvis.
Pelvis, yeah, I would too, because you've got sacrum, coccyx, there's os coxal, coxal bones, those all should fit in there.
Scapula.
Scapula, I agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so that pretty much covers our irregular ones. You can probably put hyoid in there and clavicle in there. Let's see, our next category is one that we don't often cover in Bio 110. These are called sutural bones, and this is the reason why we say most people have around 206 bones in the body. Every one of us has a different total number of bones because of the way our bones fuse together after birth. So if you look at someone's head like this, boy, you'd keep counting, wouldn't you? You've got all these individual bones here around the sutures that would actually give us many more than 206 in total. These are called sutural bones because they're trapped in the sutures of our skull, so it makes sense that we may have many more than just 206 in this case. The last category is known as our sesamoid category, and these are not only short bones, but they're also bones that have tendons growing through them. Did you know that not everybody has a patella or a kneecap? All it is a rather large sesamoid bone. So by age one, if you're going to get one, your patella should have grown in place. And so, you know, you may have it, you may not. Others of us may have tiny sesamoid bones in our joints, and they're held together in place by tendons. So you can see here there's two. There's one there and one there in this particular joint that's classified as a sesamoid. Hey, yet another reason that we say that on average people have around 206 bones. So I think that's pretty cool to think that, you know, everybody may have a different number of bones based on sutural and sesamoids in there. All right, so that should do it for this page. How about questions on 63? Let's talk about long bone anatomy. This is macro anatomy, stuff you can see with your naked eye. This comes from page 65. And we're going to first fill in the blank near the top of that page for the shaft of the bone. Number one's blank is diaphysis. Okay, number one's blank is diaphysis. So I hope you got a chance to see the tibia when it came around. So you probably got a chance to feel that the shaft here is a rather smooth type of bone. And I hope you got to feel that the inside is a rather needle-like type of bone. What you're feeling are two different types of bone tissue there. This outer portion that's smooth, that makes up the shaft of the bone, is called what?
The diaphysis.
Well, the type of bone. Periosteum, yeah. And then the bone that it's being supported by is called compact bone, which I know you guys saw in lab. The needle-like bone that you might have felt here is actually not compact bone. It's what type?
Spongy.
It's spongy, yeah. So up underneath the diaphysis, you've got a layer of periosteum covering a layer of compact bone, and then you'll notice here on the inside is some spongy bone, that very needle-like type of tissue. If you continue traveling inside the shaft of this bone, you'll notice the inside was in fact hollow, and that is a marrow cavity that stores some type of adipose tissue. So if it happens to be yellow marrow, what is its job?
Store fat.
Yeah, store fat, store energy, good. What happens if it's red marrow? What's now the job?
Blood cell.
Blood cell, yeah, so blood cell formation. And the fancy name for that?
Hematopoiesis.
Good. So I want to make sure we say that enough in here to get it straight from hemostasis or homeostasis. Other words you'll pick up on. Yes, a hematopoiesis, making blood cells.
Could I see that?
Oh, yeah, sure. All right, let's see. You've got two blanks there to fill in, or actually number two is blank to fill in, rather. This is the covering on the outside of your diaphysis, and it is called the periosteum. So let's distinguish the terms here. Peri is where?
Outside,
right. It's a wrapping outside the bone. We do have a lining inside the bone called the endosteum. And, of course, end means inside or within. So we can use those prefixes to help us differentiate those layers. What about ost? What does that tell us?
Bone,
yes. So endosteum was inside. That lines the inner portion of the diaphysis. And then now we see periosteum covers the outside. It literally wraps the outer portion of your bone. And I do want to point your attention to something called Sharpie's fibers there on your sheath. If you've ever been in a parking lot and accidentally stepped on chewing gum, especially on a hot summer day, thanks. You know, you pull your shoe up off that chewing gum and here comes all these strings of gum with your shoe. That's how Sharpie's fibers work. They are meant to adhere or stick this periosteum to the underlying bone tissue. If you tried to pull the periosteum off, it would be anchored by these types of fibers, like collagen fibers, to the underlying bone. Why is it so important that periosteum be very well stuck to the underlying compact bone?
For support,
yeah.
Protection.
And what is anchored to bone? Ligaments or tendons?
Both,
yep. So tendons anchor a bone to a muscle. And what about ligaments?
Bone
to bone, yeah. So if you have tendons and ligaments anchoring muscles and other bones together, those both grow into the periosteum. The last thing you want to have happen is that periosteum and the ligament or tendon to become jerk-free. So, yeah, we want that periosteum to be very tightly anchored to the underlying bone tissue. Okay, so I do want to mention associated with the periosteum are two types of bone cells, osteoblast and osteoclast. We've talked about these already. Which one forms new bone?
Blast.
The blast, good. And the destroyers are the clast. Good. So, these two are going to be around the outside of your bone, and they can remodel the shape depending on what kind of activities you do, whether or not you exercise, and also they can be remodeled based on your diet. So diets rich in calcium will have stronger bones because of those osteoblasts depositing extra to the outside surface. Let's see, number three looks like our next one there. The ends of our bones are known as what? Good. Yeah, this word here, epiphysis, and for plural, it's epiphyses. So epiphysis, S-I-S, is a single end of the bone. If we're talking about both ends, plural, then we use S-E-S as our suffix. And these ends of the bones are going to articulate or become joints with other bones. And for that reason, they need an extra layer of protection. So we have cartilage that covers the ends of our long bones. Because it forms a joint or an articulation, we call it articular cartilage. Now, articular cartilage is not like a new category completely. In most cases, articular cartilage is hyaline in nature. Do you remember what kind of cartilage is found covering the joints in your knee? It's not hyaline. Fibro, yes, fibrocartilage. So most joints have hyaline forming the articular cartilage, but yeah, the knee joint has fibrocartilage forming that joint. Sheldon.
What is the difference between the, is there a difference between a condition of wine and plate?
There is. There's and it depends on age and if the bone is still growing. And actually, we'll hit that in number 5 and 6, and then I'll give you some details. So let's talk about joints for just a moment. The ends of your long bone, you may notice in this picture, is all spongy bone. And that spongy bone is great for being a shock absorber. So as bones articulate past each other, they have the opportunity to rub. So the shock absorption ability of that spongy bone helps to reduce friction in the joint, as does this articular cartilage that covers where the bones articulate. We also talked about a type of membrane back in the last chapter called a synovial membrane. That type of membrane also releases a fluid to help reduce friction. So we're starting to realize that these joints are rather kind of, you know, violent places where bones rub together. We need all the help we can get in reducing the friction so they don't break off and literally have bone grinding against bone. If you ever run into that experience of having bone rubbing against bone, we have a name for it. You've heard of Uncle Arthur, right? Arthritis, yeah. And technically when the bones rub against each other, it's osteoarthritis. So that's certainly a situation we all would want to avoid. All right, so not to make you sick here, but I'm sure you've seen chicken either raw or cooked with the articular cartilage. Some people eat it, you know, it's gristly, it's very tough and chewy. But, you know, nonetheless, that is meant to be a protective device around the ends of those bones. Here's another shot of articular cartilage. You can see it's that smooth, glassy hyaline cartilage protecting the outer surface of that bone. So this does take us to numbers 5 and 6. Number 5 is called an epiphyseal plate. Number 5 is called the epiphyseal plate, while number 6 is an epiphyseal line. Okay, number 5 is epiphyseal plate, while number 6 is an epiphyseal line. The difference between the two is what they're made of. An epiphyseal plate is seen in young growing bone. You're born with epiphyseal plates. You should have these layers of hyaline cartilage until you're into your middle to late teenage years. So by age 18, your epiphyseal plate should be converting to bone, compact bone. So the case of this bone here, it looks like it's still hyaline cartilage. So we can say safely this person is probably under age 21. So that means that the bone is still able to grow and lift. Between the ages of 18 and 21, we start to see the conversion of the epiphyseal plate into an epiphyseal line. Once we see that conversion take place, we no longer see lengthening of our bones. Most people have stopped growing by age 18, and certainly by age 21, we're past that point of growing. And by age 25, the epiphyseal line has completed its ossification. So that means that there's no chance of lengthening in those bones that have had those epiphyseal plates there.
At that point, do they just grow in width?
They would just grow in width, exactly. Yeah. And we can grow in width at any time during your life. We can only grow in length up to about, you know, late teenage years. So nice clean layer right here of hyaline cartilage. That is our epiphyseal plate, and that is what divides and grows to provide lengthening of our bones. What do you know about the growth rate of cartilage? Or the heal rate of cartilage? Really slow, yeah. So, you know, most babies are somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 inches long when they're born. And if you think about it, to grow from 20 inches to something like 5 feet, which is 60 inches, can take something like 10 or even 15 years. So, yeah, that kind of sings the song of being a really slow-growing tissue. You're waiting for hyaline cartilage to divide in order to make yourself grow taller. So, again, what age is this person? No older than what?
18.
Probably no older than 18, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, really nice, clean, distinct line of hyaline cartilage here. What you're looking at on this end of the bone is the epiphysis. These pockets are spongy bone full of marrow. So, kind of cool that you can see that up close.
Is that what they're going to do, bone marrow?
They can pull marrow out of that spongy bone space, sure. Yeah, and they can pull it out of the marrow cavity, which may be a little harder. It may be easier to pull it out of the spongy bone cavities, depending on the bones that are close to the skin surface, like your hip bone, for instance.
Is it the same as like a growth plate?
It is exactly that. It is a growth plate, yeah. In this x-ray, you'll notice that we've got the femur sitting up top and the tibia down below, and there's the fibula sitting over there. Do you notice these lines through the ends of the bone?
Yeah.
Okay. They are not lines at all. They're, in fact, the growth plates or the epiphyseal plates. And the reason they show up as a dark line is because they're made not of bone, but of what?
Cartilage.
Cartilage, yeah. Yeah. So if you happen to break cartilage, yikes, right? What does that tell us is going to happen to the growth plate? It may be slower and it may stop. And why do you think this is especially a bad problem for your legs? Yep, one's going to be longer than the other. So arms, it's not such a big deal, right? But you can get legs out of balance, and then the spine has problems too. So yeah, having one leg longer than the other is certainly an issue for epiphyseal plate fractures like you see here. I had a student in class many years ago. She had pituitary dwarfism. At age 5, they diagnosed her and started giving her growth hormone injections. She grew to 5'2" and was very happy with the outcome. Alternately, if she had not been giving growth hormone injections, she would have stayed in the 4-foot range, lower 4-foot range. So what they do for kids that have pituitary dwarfism is they'll x-ray their hands. If they get the picture on the left where epiphyseal cartilages are still present, they'll still give them growth hormone injections. They know that their bodies can still handle growing taller. If, however, they get this picture on the right where epiphyseal lines have set up, you'll notice there are no longer the dark spaces at the end of the bones where growth can take place. So should they continue giving injections if they get the picture on the right?
No.
So why not?
No room for growth.
Yeah, so they're not growing taller anymore with the picture on the right. In fact, the only things the bones could grow then is
wider.
Yep. So in her case, she stopped having injections at age 14. So it must have been about the time that they realized she had gone from having plates to having lines. So in this picture, can you tell me which one is an active growing growth plate? Yeah, how did you know? You see the spaces, yeah. So that tells me that those bones are still lengthening. The bones on the left, though, what do you see instead? And what type of tissue makes up that line? Yeah, compact bone. So no longer can it expand like we saw with the hyaline cartilage on the plates on the right. Let's see. I do want to mention the picture on the bottom of your page is on your test. So you'll want to feel comfortable labeling it. In fact, the labels are hidden up there above in the words, so it gives you an instantly correct labeling.
What's that
page? That is 65. Let's talk about page 66. I know you guys have seen compact bone in lab. We're going to talk a little more about the structure here, and we're also going to talk about spongy bone as well. So I know in lab you've probably heard that compact bone is alternately known as osseous tissue. Spongy bone has a different name too. It sometimes is called cancellous tissue. In this picture, you can get a good sense of how these two tissues work together. The outside of all of our bones is a covering of compact bone tissue. It's very smooth, it's very tough, it is very, guess what, compact. So it's very tightly packed with these rings of calcium salts. So all of this stuff out here is compact bone on the outer surface. Once you come into the bone, though, you get this sense of a very open, spongy, needle-like bone. All of this in here is spongy bone. They serve two totally different purposes. The compact bone on the outside is meant to protect the bone on the inside. The spongy on the inside is meant to be open and airy, and it's a great shock absorber. And you can see how close the head of the humerus right here fits into the glenoid cavity. So, you know, there's a great opportunity for rubbing. So it's, again, a way for us to do some shock absorption there. So let's talk about osteocytes first. These are the blanks for number one. Osteocytes are mature bone cells. Osteocytes are no longer making new bone, nor are they breaking down bone, so it is their job to be mature cells. And because bone is a living tissue, they must constantly be nourished by blood from blood vessels. And we'll have to figure out a way to get the blood to them. These osteocytes also sit in a tiny air pocket. What is the air pocket called? Lacuna. Good. So it's tiny lake. So this air pocket surrounding those osteocytes are lacuna. So in this picture, all these darker spots are osteocytes. They were trapped in the matrix they were building, and they are surrounded now by an air pocket. But because bone is a living tissue, we have to nourish them, and we'll talk about some canals that carry blood and nutrients to those bone cells. So this is very much a living, dynamic tissue. They say that within a lifetime of around 80 years, that your skeleton will totally be recycled and rebuilt on average 6 times. So it really gives you the idea that your bones are not just a static entity. They're constantly being replaced and rebuilt with calcium as your body uses it and then deposits it here. The next term there, number two, is the matrix. Number two, the matrix of bone tissue. So where do you get calcium from? Yeah, dairy products, right? So vitamin D helps deposit that calcium to your bones. Dairy products contain it. Of course, green leafy vegetables are another good source of calcium. So when we eat things like that that have calcium, our bodies can deposit that excess to our bones. Having excess calcium in your bloodstream can be rather dangerous. So our body's mechanism for storing calcium is just to deposit it into our bones and teeth for the next time we need it. I did want to show you this. The calcium in our bones makes up around 60 or about 39% of our bone tissue. And there's other minerals here like potassium, sodium, magnesium, carbonate, and phosphate. So what we have is not just calcium, but actually crystals. And we call those crystals hydroxyapatite. Okay, so it sounds like hydroxycut that you've probably seen commercials for, maybe. Okay, so these calcium phosphate crystals are the majority of our bones' weight, and they're forming something called calcium hydroxide, and the ultimate form here is hydroxyapatite crystals. Let me explain, though, what this is. You've touched chalk before, right? Okay, I can drop this on the floor. It shatters into hundreds of tiny pieces. That is how the bone is made. This is very brittle. It's mostly calcium and other minerals that are mixed in there, but it's not by itself very flexible. You know, I certainly can't give this any kind of a bend or it's going to break automatically on me. So if our bones were made up of nothing but these calcium salts called hydroxyapatite crystals, you would not be able to sway or bend those bones at all without experiencing some kind of break or fracture. So how do we give our bones a little bit of flexibility?
Collagen.
Yeah, collagen fibers, good. So when you put collagen fibers in this brittle calcium matrix, now you've got the ability to give a little bit of sway, a little bit of bend without breaking that bone. All right, so notice the ranking here. Calcium phosphate crystals called hydroxyapatite make up the majority of your bone tissue. You'll notice that collagen fibers make up around 1/3 of the bone's tissue. They contribute to the flexibility of your bone tissue. And then finally, the bone cells, like osteocytes, only account for about 2% of your bone's weight. So they have a very small contribution to what your bone tissues do. So kind of interesting stuff here. If you have an off ratio, like if you have too much calcium and not enough collagen, what do you think happens to people's bones?
Brittle.
They're brittle. Yeah, you've heard of brittle bone disease, right? Okay? So people with brittle bone disease have too much calcium and not enough collagen to give them the flexibility. Likewise, let's flip it the other direction. What if you have an ample amount of calcium, or sorry, ample amount of collagen and not enough calcium? Now what happens to your bones? Not strong. Yeah, you need the calcium for the support. You need the collagen for the flexibility. So the ratio has to be right between those two to give your bones the strength and the flexibility that we need. We also have canals, and these canals are present in your bone tissue to help nourish those living bone cells. So the tiniest of the canals are called canaliculi. We also have canals called central canals. And we also have sideways canals called perforating canals. And I left you some space there in case you would like to draw out what I'm getting ready to put on the board. I'm going to draw you out a set of bone cells with osteons and all that good stuff so we can examine all that setup. I think I'll get the lights on for you for just a moment. Start you off with a central canal. A central canal is going to be home to a blood vessel. I abbreviated here as BV or nerve. And so we expect central to be in the, guess what, center, right? No surprise there. So it's going to be in the center of a set of calcium rings. So what I'm putting down around the central canal are rings and rings of calcium salts. These rings, by the way, are called lamellae. So you can call them lamellae, lamellae. These, nonetheless, are the rings of salts that are laid down around that central canal. So when we lay down these rings of calcium salts, we're going to deposit in there some of these osteocytes that were originally osteoblasts. So osteocytes are going to be trapped in the matrix as they build these rings. I'm just going to put some spots around here. And we know each one is housed by a little tiny air pocket. What's that air pocket called?
Lacuna.
Good. So imagine these osteocytes being stuck in these air pockets. If we don't nourish them with blood and nutrients and oxygen, they're going to die. So what we do is we have teeny tiny canals built from the central canal that radiate out like a bloodshot eye to each one of these osteocytes. So I'm going to draw on a few of these little canaliculi. And there's also canals that connect neighboring canaliculi. So the word canaliculi sounds like can I lick you lie?
Okay, I know that's a really weird pronunciation, but when you look at the word, it doesn't really tell you how to pronounce it. So a canaliculus is a single canal connecting your osteocytes together, or perhaps back to that central canal. So canaliculi are multiple canals, and they're teeny tiny canals that carry nutrients, oxygen, even waste products between these various osteocytes. We have one last type of canal. So what I'm gonna do is draw another osteon over here with another central canal. And we're gonna draw a connector between these two canals. The connector between these two canals is called a perforating canal. Okay, so I know you've probably heard the term haversian before. Central canals are sometimes called haversian canals. Likewise, we also have an osteon or a haversian system pictured up here as well. So what should I include if I circle my osteon?
The whole unit.
The whole thing, right. So central canal, the rings of calcium salts, all those osteocytes. Good, so this entire structure here is going to be called an osteon, alternately known as a haversian system. And we just did another one.
You may have the ladies something like that.
It'll be a multiple choice setup. I'll ask you to pick out, like, pick me out the central canal, or tell me what the whole thing's called.
Oh.
Yeah, I won't make you guys draw this thing from scratch.
Oh.
Canaliculi carry oxygen and waste products?
Waste, yeah. Basically, any kind of connection between cells. So waste products, nutrients, gases, all that stuff. Chilling. That is spongy bone. So this is all
common. Okay.
Yeah, and we'll fast forward to that in just a minute, and I'll show you trabeculae. Would you guys like a break to clear your head for a few minutes? Because we're kind of, I don't know how much time we're going to have toward the end for questions. Let's do 5 minutes today. If you can come back around 9:05, then we'll just try to save some time for you then. So these are canaliculi. They're the connectors between your adjacent osteocytes. They also connect your osteocytes back to the central canal. So they're very tiny little canals. In these pictures, what looks like lines, these see look like lines connecting these cells together. Those are in fact the canaliculi, and they should be radiating out from that central canal. The lacuna is an air pocket that surrounds that osteocyte, which is the dark spot inside. More canaliculi, they're actually radiating out from the central canal. It gives this bone kind of like a hairy appearance. It looks like hairs are coming out from the center. So, you know, we know collagen fibers are found in bone tissue, but that's not actually them. They're not showing up in this picture, those instead of the canaliculi radiating. Hard to see, but the Volkmann's canal or perforating canal connects two adjacent central canals. So you've got a central canal here. It looks like another one may have been down here, and they're going sideways between those two canals. And then this picture kind of has a variety of all of this stuff. So if I can, I'll use an analogy for you to help explain what's going on with these canals.
Imagine if you have a high-rise building, 50 stories tall, okay? Huge high-rise buildings. Some high-rise buildings have numerous elevators that run up and down in that building. And so we'll put several elevators here inside that building. Those are called central canals because they run up and down the length of that building, right? So let's say that you're going to get off on the 35th floor on this building, and you're going to walk a big hallway from one bank of elevators to the other bank of elevators. What kind of canal is that?
Connecting.
Well, it's a big, wide hallway. Yeah, perforating. Okay. And if you're heading to a little office space somewhere around there, you may now travel to a canaliculus. So it's teeny tiny little hallways versus bigger hallways versus these vertical hallways, which are the central canals. So basically that's what we've got here in bone is little pathways for blood and nutrients, waste products, oxygen to travel inside those canals. Do y'all have any questions so far on the three major types of canals and compact bone tissue?
For confirmation purposes,
okay.
Just for the difference between the Wolfman's canal and the canalicula, they connect the lacunae or the apophyses or the osteocytes.
That's correct.
And are they connecting them to the central canal or are they just connecting them into together?
Like both, actually. They can do both jobs.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming the Wolfman's canal connects the central canal to another central canal.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Did y'all hear Gwen's explanation?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you have any questions? Anything I can further explain or clarify on those three canal types? Okay. So in this picture, you notice there's lots and lots of osteons, and the way we know that is there are numerous central canals, and they're each surrounded by their own set of rings. There's another one. And each little dark spot there is an osteocyte hiding in its little tiny air pocket called a lacuna. Down here happens to be a perforating canal connecting one central canal to another central canal. And this picture probably isn't highly magnified enough to be able to see the canaliculi, but if they were there, they would have been radiating out from what?
Central
canal, yep. And then it connected together those neighboring osteocytes. So. I'd have one that's a little more up close, like that, or maybe one like that, where you can really see the detail. Yeah. Very bottom of your page is spongy bone, also known as cancellous bone. And we actually can see with the naked eye that it has open spaces, thus the name spongy bone, and it has bony bars that provide strength. Those bony bars that provide strength are called trabeculae. And that is your blank there on the bottom of the page. For those who experience osteoporosis later in life, part of the porousness that comes along with that bone disorder is the loss of trabeculae. So it gives us the sense that those trabeculae are providing a strength for our bone. And if you lose them, then you're losing the scaffolding strength inside that the bone is going to provide. In this previous picture, you can see that that spongy bone and all of its trabeculae are found in the ends, and they're found under the compact bone, and they're again about shock absorption and providing some strength for that compact bone on the outside surface. So it's amazing to think we can put, 100, 200, even 300 or 400 pounds worth of weight on spongy bone, even as airy as that stuff is, and it still can support whatever weight we put on there. Imagine carrying a 50-pound box and adding that to your weight. No wonder we have to have strong bones and strong spongy bone to be able to not fracture under the weight. So speaking of bone growth and making bones strong and supportive, let's talk about ossification. That's going to be over a couple of pages for you. Thank you, 68. So let's clarify the term ossification at the top of the page with calcification up there. Ossification is the process of turning other tissues into bone. And we do that by calcifying the tissue. We actually deposit calcium into those tissues to make them hard and strong. We're going to talk about three types of ossification. One is intramembranous. And really, we're not going to do any details about intramembranous. This is how the facial bones fuse together. You know, as a child, your face looked different than it does as you get older, and it will continue to change shape. But the most marked change is during those childhood years when the facial bones begin to fuse together. It is a totally different process than growing bones in length or in width. So we'll leave intramembranous alone. We're going to focus instead on lengthening bones through endochondral ossification and widening bones through appositional ossification. So I left you a little bit of space near the bottom of your page. If you want to jot down some pictures with me, I'm going to use what I've got drawn on the board over here to explain how bones grow in length.
You said in length?
In length, uh-huh. So we're going to start from the time that a baby is growing in a fetus, you know, as a fetus in the uterus of a woman. And the bones, of course, are going to be incredibly tiny. And during the length of the pregnancy, the bones will begin to lengthen. Bones actually don't start out life as calcified structures. They actually start out life as cartilage. And it's through the fetal growth period and childhood years that we see the cartilage skeleton transformed into a hardened, calcified skeleton. So what we end up having when bones originally are made is an ossification center, right dead center of the diaphysis. And we call that a primary ossification center. It's not going to stay there. It's actually going to split, and it's going to travel to each end of that bone. And that's going to allow for the bone to begin to lengthen as it grows longer. So we're not going to really talk anymore about the primary ossification center. Instead, let's turn our attention to the secondary ossification center. So what does the word ossification mean that we're doing? Yeah, turning something into bone, right? So this cartilage that we're working with is going to be something that we transform into bone tissue. So here it is in the center of this bone when the bone was first forming in a fetus, and here it has migrated to the epiphysis. So this little line here that I put is called our secondary ossification center. Ossification is a process of turning other tissues into bone. When we start life, our bones are not actually calcified hard bones. They're rubbery cartilage bones. And I hesitate to even use the word bone because I think all of us have this mental image of a hardened, calcified structure. But through the process of growing as a fetus and growing up as a child, the cartilage that makes up our bones originally is transformed into a hardened, calcified structure. So when we start out life, our bones are itty-bitty, and the very center is a primary ossification center that migrates to either end of your bone. So when we zoom in, we can actually see this region right here called our secondary ossification center. There are bone-forming cells that take up residence there. Are they called osteoclasts or osteoblasts?
Osteoblasts.
Good. And so it is their job to turn the cartilage here into actually calcified, hardened bone tissue.
And in fact, those osteoblasts are what start laying down on the outside, creating our periosteum, and they're all over the whole entire covering of the bone, and they're also here at the secondary ossification center. So to make it easy to see the difference, I'm going to put a layer of X's across there, and that's going to be my epithelial plate. Okay, so that layer of X's, that's going to be my epithelial plate.
Secondary ossification.
That's it. My dotted line is my ossification center, and my X's are the epithelial plate. So, what type of tissue makes up your epithelial plate? Cartilage, right? And you know about cartilage, it's really slow to divide. So even as a fetus, babies grow very slowly. As an adult, you know, ever approaching those years toward 18, our growth rate is about the fastest it's ever going to be, which may be 5 or 6 inches in a year. But nonetheless, you know, that's still slow growth in terms of cartilage growth. It's a very slow-growing tissue. So let's add another layer of hyaline cartilage. Let's say that our epithelial plate divided and it lengthened this bone. Okay, so I add an extra layer of hyaline cartilage in there. Jessica.
So when is it safe to say that endocardial ossification occurs in therapeutic?
Yes. She said, is it safe to say that endochondral ossification occurs at the epiphysis? And yes.
Okay, add a
random
question.
Okay.
Is that what causes, like, growing pain?
Yes.
When you're a kid?
Especially, like, in your femur, because when your bones lengthen, then the muscles have to lengthen, too. So you've got probably aches and pains at the ends of those bones, and then the muscles are getting stretched as the bones grow. So it's just painful all around. Yeah.
Additional
application
of therapy.
Yeah, it makes the bone grow wider. Yeah.
When I was younger, I experienced a lot of that pain, but my husband did not. Do you think that has to do with pain tolerance?
Probably the sensitivity, that may be it, or maybe how. Maybe the muscles and the bones are growing at the same rate, and maybe there was less of that tension between the, you know, the muscle and the bone being pulled longer too. Yeah.
I grew really, really fast, so I had a lot of growing pains.
Yeah.
I was actually kind of excited. Someone told me, and I should have not gone by here, so they're like, you don't really stop growing until you're 23. I'm like, I've got 2 more years. I can grow 2 more inches taller. I'm waiting for it. And then it's just like, it calcifies at 21. Like,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Heels, it is.
It's the game I were right.
Is it normal for a doctor always to be experiencing that pain?
Probably. I've got a 10-year-old, and she's talked about her legs hurting for years.
Yeah, because my son, right, that's what their teachers were saying to me, that they think that he's having heart pains because every day his leg hurt, his knee hurt, his arm, every day. Something
is
hurting, so they would say that it's probably growing pains.
Like,
I mean, think about
that. And it seems to cycle, like, you know, at least for my 10-year-old, she'll say she hurts, her legs hurt, and then I won't hear about it for a few weeks,
yeah.
And it's back, and you know, you're like, what's going on, you know? Just growing. Okay, so we've got an extra layer of cartilage that we laid down. These osteoblasts in here are going to be marching forward. And they're coming toward that layer of hyaline cartilage. What are they going to do to that first layer of hyaline cartilage? They're going to turn it into
bone.
Yeah. So now I'm just going to shade over those X's because no longer is that hyaline cartilage. That's now my bone tissue.
And so very slowly, I'm going to eventually have another layer of hyaline cartilage that's built. And what do you think my osteoblasts do next time?
Turn that into bone.
Turn that into bone. So they just play catch up, right, with that layer. And you can see that over time, we've actually made our bone grow longer from that epiphyseal plate. I have a mental image of paving. I don't know if you've ever watched paving trucks. You know, they dump the rocks out there, and then they come along with a steamroller, and then it's, voila, it's road. So I kind of have this mental image of hyaline cartilage being thrown out like rocks, and then the steamroller are the osteoblasts that come along and turn that into actual calcified bone. So it all works as long as your rate is okay, right? Because around age 18 to 21, your hyaline cartilage is really slow to divide. So I'm just going to put a layer across here for the conversation. And our osteoblasts are sitting right there in our ossification center. And osteoblasts are like, come on, hurry up, divide. And so they start taking a little bit more, a little bit more. And then what has happened to your hyaline cartilage? Stops producing, right. So by around age 18 to 21, your osteoblasts literally steamroll over your hyaline cartilage. And you no longer have an epiphyseal plate. You have this shadow here called an epiphyseal line. Yeah, and that tells me you're at least 18, if not older. Okay. There we go. So do you see the difference between the epiphyseal plate and the ossification center? Okay, which one of those has the osteoblast? Yeah, ossification center. And it's turning that layer of hyaline cartilage into bone. Yeah. I also want to tell you a little bit more about this story, because as we're turning cartilage into bone and we're chasing after that hyaline cartilage layer, we are also opening up an internal cavity here. There are lysosomes that help to digest and get rid of old cartilage tissue. And there's also osteoclasts in this marrow cavity that are remodeling and opening up this space so that we can store marrow in here. So that marrow cavity space is created thanks to osteoclasts and lysosomes.
So people who have the condition where they don't stop growing, they just never get rid of their plate.
Yeah, so their plate still has the X's there, and the osteoblasts are just courteously falling right behind. Yeah. Okay. Let me make sure I hit all your terms on there. Looks like we did.
I think I have a question about the appositional growth.
Sure.
So when you're saying wider, like, in my head, I'm just not seeing a big, wide, fat bone, so.
And it's not, yeah, you're right, it's not like it just plumps up on us. Okay. And you really wouldn't notice it anyway, because I couldn't tell you if my humerus grew or not, or my femur, because there's so much flesh around that you're not going to see it for the most part. So why don't we talk about that, since we're kind of in the territory. So at any time during your life, you can experience bone growth in width. That's what appositional ossification is. And we know that the periosteum is the covering on which specific part of your bone?
The diaphysis.
Diaphysis, right. So I'm just going to put a little layer there. And once again, these are my osteoblasts.
So when you're, say, let's say you're on a dairy kick, you know, summertime I'm on an ice cream kick, right? You know, milkshakes, that kind of stuff. Maybe the rest of the year I don't want that stuff. So I'm having a lot of calcium in the summertime. When you have a lot of calcium and you're older than age 18, there's only one way for your bones to grow, and that is to make them wider and stronger. So osteoblasts are actually being fed by blood vessels that come in here with that calcium. And what those osteoblasts do is they actually lay down those osteon rings on the outer surface of your bone tissue. So this now becomes my new layer of bone, and I start putting another layer of osteoblast, and I continue to make my bone grow just a little wider as I continue depositing more and more calcium to the outer surface. Let's say come wintertime, I'm not really interested in having ice cream or dairy products or anything of that sort. What comes along and destroys that bone matrix?
Osteoclast.
Osteoclast, yes. So the bone will shrink back in a little bit and, of course, loses calcium to the bloodstream. So the remodeling here is highly dependent upon two main things. What your diet is, if you've got calcium in your diet, and whether or not you put stress on those bones.
So I can be big boned.
You can be big boned, yes. And it's going to show up in places where we don't see it, unfortunately. But yeah, all the long bones are going to enlarge in size. You're not going to really see it other places. So, you know, there's too much flesh hiding all those bones underneath. So this is something that can occur from day one of life to the last day of life. This is the remodeling process that makes bones grow wider and thicker. So, you know, totally different from making them grow longer during those childhood years. How about questions on appositional growth? So now that we've talked about endochondral ossification, I wanted to once again show you this picture. There is your epiphyseal plate. That's a layer of hyaline cartilage. And right underneath it is a layer of ossification. So what is happening to the cartilage in that zone? Creating bone, yeah, so turning it into calcified bone. And another really pretty picture, you've got your epiphyseal plate of hyaline cartilage, and it's quite likely that our bone ossification layer, that secondary layer, is right underneath. So it's going to be chasing behind that epiphyseal plate. And so now when you see a picture like this, where you've got epiphyseal lines, you say, oh yeah, that layer of ossification must have caught up with the bone growth and calcified the epiphyseal plate. Okay. So that should take us down there to the bottom of the page. Do y'all have any questions so far on page 68?
What is the
low ossification? It's going to be bone marrow if we go down low enough, or perhaps some spongy bone. Let's see, let's pull back up a picture. Yeah, that all of this up here is spongy bone at the top, and then down below, that's probably some spongy bone as well. All right, how about other questions so far? Let me give you a moment to jot down hormones on blanks 1, 2, and 3. This is found on the top of page 69. We've got parathyroid hormone, or PTH for short. Calcitonin is number 2. Growth hormone is number 3. So we're going to learn in some coming soon chapters that calcium is necessary for muscles to contract and for nerves to send their nerve impulses. And we need a correct amount of calcium in our bloodstream at all times in order for those muscles and nerves to function properly. Too much calcium means that we may calcify other areas of our bodies that should not be calcified, For instance, heart valves can be calcified, and they're not meant to be hardened. They're meant to be flexible. So that means that all of the excess calcium in our bloodstream should be stored in our bones and our teeth for a later time. So the first two hormones here, parathyroid hormone and calcitonin, actually work opposite to each other. They are going to work by a negative feedback loop to maintain blood calcium levels. In your neck, you have a gland sitting right beneath your Adam's apple. Both males and females have an Adam's apple. It's just more pronounced in males than it is in females due to testosterone. So if you can find the little lumpy Adam's apple there around your thigh, or it's called thyroid cartilage, right underneath it is a little fleshy butterfly-shaped gland, and that's your thyroid gland. The thyroid gland makes calcitonin. The parathyroid glands, which sit on the backside, are going to make parathyroid hormone. So these two glands sit right next to each other, right around your trachea, and it is their job to regulate your blood calcium levels. That's why people who have their thyroid glands removed may then have trouble regulating their calcium levels, because this is all tied in with the thyroid and parathyroid glands. So let's talk about parathyroid first. You'll notice on your sheet, the job of parathyroid hormone is to raise blood calcium levels when they're too low. We use a certain type of bone-destroying cell called what?
Osteoclast.
Osteoclast, good. Guess where the osteoclasts are found? Yeah, right along the periosteum of the bone, and it's their job to destroy the bone matrix and release the calcium into the bloodstream. So PTH is a destroyer. It's one that's going to activate those destructive osteoclasts. Its job is to raise blood calcium levels when blood calcium is too low. Because calcitonin, number two, is an antagonist, is it doing the same job as PTH or the opposite job?
Opposite.
Doing the opposite job, good. So calcitonin, number two, is going to lower blood calcium levels. It deposits excess calcium to our bones and our teeth, making them stronger. What types of cells are employed?
Osteoblast.
Osteoblast, good.
So question, why would a doctor prescribe you calcium pills? Would it be because of your parathyroid hormone, or would it be because of your calcitonin?
It may be that parathyroid hormone is too active in removing calcium, or that your calcium blood calcium levels are too low, somehow revolving around the regulation with those two hormones. In most adults, it's PTH that's the primary regulator of blood calcium, not calcitonin. So PTH may not be doing its job entirely properly. Let me give you a couple of examples of how these two work. Let's talk about a mom who is breastfeeding her baby. If that mom is breastfeeding, she needs calcium placed from her own bones into the breast milk. Which is the calcium-releasing hormone, PTH or calcitonin?
PTH,
right? It raises blood calcium. So for a mom who is breastfeeding, what is happening to her bones?
Taking away
calcium, right. There's an old saying that goes, for every child a tooth is lost. Some moms have cavities when they're pregnant or breastfeeding. Other moms simply lose their teeth. They fall out. Mm-hmm. So you can see that. Was that you? I have a lot of people that have, like either a mouthful of cavities or, you know, teeth that just loosen and fall. It's thank you, PTH.
I'm brushing my teeth and my
tooth
chip.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Pregnant or breastfeeding at that point?
I was pregnant. I just had my son. So I was breastfeeding.
I hear that. Every time we talk about this, somebody always has a story with this, so it must be quite common.
I couldn't get it fixed before. I think I was pregnant because I couldn't get it fixed until after. I had to walk around with
the chips. Ouch. The qualms of being a mom, right, is having teeth. Yeah. Flip it to the other side. If you like calcium-rich foods or you take a calcium supplement to keep your blood calcium levels in check, now which hormone lowers your blood calcium?
Calcitonin.
Calcitonin, right. And if you're older than age 18 and you're eating all this calcium-rich food, which type of ossification are you doing?
Appositional.
Appositional, right. So your bones will grow wider, thicker, stronger, better able to support your body's weight or whatever stresses may come along. Let's see, our number three there is called growth hormone, and this particular one does exactly as its name implies. It tells your body to grow. So if you're under age 18 and you're looking at lengthening your bones, it makes your epiphyseal plates divide and lengthen. So it is the one responsible for making you grow taller from childhood up into the teenage years. After that period of time, it may drive a little bit of this appositional growth, but for the most part, our growth hormone levels tend to decrease after our childhood teenage years are over. Speaking of growth hormone, there's actually several disorders that I'd like to mention to you. The first one is excess growth, and this is called gigantism. The term hypersecretion there means what? Yeah, too much, above the normal levels. So in the case of gigantism, this starts early. I've heard of five-year-olds being 6 feet tall that have gigantism. So, you know, you're talking about from the gate out, they're going to be growing excessively. You'll notice this man here on the left has gigantism. You know, it may or may not stop when he reaches puberty in the late teenage years, and he may continue to grow up into his adulthood years. The problem with gigantism is the bones are long and thin, as are the muscles, and they're unable to really support the body's weight. So you may have a 450-pound giant who has horrible joint issues, a rib cage that's built for a 5-foot-tall person, but yet they're 8 feet tall. So we have this connotation that giants are actually strong and mobile, but in fact, a lot of them are crippled and die because of the crushing body's weight. So.
Question.
Sure.
Is it possible to have, like, not as extreme gigantism, but, like, in a way where it's kind of concerning with children? For example, my cousin, he was 12 when his growth spurt came, and it came in at a really fast rate that even the doctors were shocked, because at 12 years old, he was 4'2".
Wow.
And by the end of that summer, he had reached an astonishing 5'7".
Ooh, goodness.
And then the next year, he finally hit 6 foot.
Wow.
And this was all before 14. So I'm not, and right now he's 17 and 6'5".
Wow.
But we're not sure, like, is it really going to be gigantism to the point to where it would be extreme, or is it just a really fast growth spurt?
Yeah, and you're right, you won't really know until he stops growing. Is 6'5" going to be his final destination of height?
I don't even think so.
I mean, considering he's had that's an enormous spurt. What, a foot and some inches? That's an incredible amount of growth. I guess if he has slowed over recent years, the hope is that he's not going to continue to have those massive spurts. Yeah, I guess I'll have to wait and see what happens with him. Yeah. In recent history, our tallest person is this guy at 8'11", 439 pounds. And at age 22, he was not done growing, and which is odd because normally 18 to 21 is when we see that process stop. The catch is most of us go through puberty sometime during our teenage years, and puberty is what stops your upward growth. Puberty releases sex hormones, and sex hormones say to that secondary ossification line, go faster. And it also tells your epiphyseal plate to divide faster. And so eventually, you know, we're going to catch up with the cartilage layer and turn it into bone. But in his case, without testosterone, his epiphyseal plate continues to divide, and his ossification center continues to harden the bone. So, unfortunately, we don't know how the story would have ended. He died in 1940 at age 22 from a blister that developed from a custom leg brace. So, again, here it's the joint issues that he had. That's his dad pictured there with him. Down at Myrtle Beach, the main portion at Ripley's, believe it or not, they do have a wax statue of this guy that you can see from the street. You don't have to pay to go in. You can just look in there and see him. He is buried in Alton, Illinois as the Alton Giant in a concrete vault 9 feet long. They were scared that somebody would dig him up and parade his body around that massive skeleton. As it was, though, he was touring with the circus back then as, you know, of course, a giant. So, really unfortunate situation. Nowadays, we would know what to do with this. Back in the late 30s and early 40s, I doubt they would have known how to have treated gigantism. Testosterone could have been a way to go to help encourage puberty for him and stop that upward growth. Right now, 8'3" is our tallest man. You'll notice there he is with a cane. He's in his early 40s, so most 40-year-olds don't have to tote around a cane for crippled joints, but that is typical with gigantism. Yao Ming also had gigantism. He had a basketball star. He retired because, guess what? Joint issues, right? He did not have acromegaly, which is another issue with growth hormone. This woman at 7'8", also in her 40s, passed away. Again, joint issues. The rib cage does not support lung and heart growth, so she could not accommodate her huge body size. This is acromegaly. This can occur from excess growth hormone after the early 20s. It involves an enlargement of the extremities. So facial bones, hands, and feet are all growing, as well as all the other bones appositionally. Why do you think it mostly shows up in the face, hands, and feet?
Because they're flat bones. Usually composed of not as much long bones.
And where's the tissue the thickest on your body? Muscles, right? So would you know it if your humerus got bigger today?
No.
I'd have no clue, right? Would you know it if your fingers grew wider over a course of months?
Yeah.
Would you know it if your jawbone got bigger?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So there's a lot of flesh over your femur, your lower legs, your arm bones. You're not going to notice if those bones widen through appositional growth, but we do notice it in face and hands and feet bones. So in this picture, you can see acromegaly of the hands. Notice this guy, massive changes in his facial structure over his lifetime. His hands are pictured there because his hands have enlarged. Andre the Giant also had acromegaly in addition to gigantism. So he must have gone through puberty. That stopped his upward growth. But because he still had excess growth hormone coming from his pituitary gland, his bones continued to widen. So that's why he had the very deep voice and the facial features that you see here. Yao Ming, I mentioned, did not have acromegaly. You'll notice his facial features aren't exaggerated like Andre the Giant's.
My uncle is 7'1", so does that mean that
he's... They would say probably some form of it, and it can be genetic, it can be DNA, it can be mutations, and then alternately it can be pituitary gland and all the business that goes on with growth hormone there too.
My family's really tall, but he just happens to be the tallest.
Wow, I'm guessing they would probably say gigantism of some form. And it can be genetic, it can run in families, so you can have a tall group of people. Yep. On the other end of the spectrum, we can have what's called pituitary dwarfism, meaning that the person is dwarfed due to the pituitary gland. And this is, again, the fault of having not enough growth hormone. So technically, to be a dwarf, you would cap out no taller than 4'7". So, you know, that is actually what we see here with these two people. Notice that their body proportions are like child's proportions. They don't have a big torso and short legs. They just look like kids in the picture, and that's classic what we see with pituitary dwarfism. Let's see, calcitriol is middle of your page. This one is another name for vitamin D3. And I mention that because how do you make vitamin D?
Sun,
yeah. So calcitriol is just an alternate name for vitamin D3. And of course, we make that in exposure to the sun. That's just the more specific form that we talk about here with calcitriol. I'm not sure if there's a D1 or a D2, but D3 is calcitriol. So we would want to be specific in referencing that one. So calcitriol also helps you deposit calcium to your bones. It makes your bones strong and healthy. So thinking back, does it do a job similar to PTH or calcitonin?
Calcitonin,
good. So calcitriol and calcitonin both help deposit calcium to our bones. Okay, calcitriol and calcitonin both help deposit calcium to our bones. keeping that straight, you'll notice that both words have calcium hidden in there. That's a good reminder. So I'd like to toss out two problems with calcitriol and vitamin D3. As an adult, people run into an issue of having osteomalacia. Osteo as a prefix means bone. What about malacia?
Softening,
yeah. So unfortunately, this comes from age and having less vitamin D in your diet or less sun exposure. And what happens is the bones are soft and fracture under the body's weight. Yeah, so let's hit those questions down there. The cause is a vitamin D deficiency. That's for osteomalacia. Okay, cause of osteomalacia is vitamin D deficiency. How are bones affected? They are soft and fracture. Yep. And the age group that is affected?
Adults,
that's right. I can't help but think about this. You know, they tell us stay out of the sun, it'll give you cancer. Okay, so we stay out of the sun. They say if you go in the sun, slather yourself an inch thick in sunscreen. Okay, so we slather ourselves with sunscreen. And then we turn around and we work inside all day where there's no sunlight, right? And so we are not getting sun and vitamin D exposure that way. So the only way to get vitamin D then is how?
Milk.
Milk, yeah. Dairy products, leafy greens. So milk then becomes our source of vitamin D. So the jobs that we have that put us inside for so many hours a day prevent us from making vitamin D naturally through sun exposure. Kids can also develop vitamin D deficiencies. In kids, it's called rickets. Same issue here. The cause is a vitamin D deficiency. Once again, bones are soft and will fracture. This time it's a children issue. Kids can develop vitamin D deficiencies with rickets. So I wanted to show you vitamin D deficiency in a child. You'll notice the legs here are bowed under the body's weight. This is a case of a person who may not be able to metabolize vitamin D and the bones have bowed. I don't mean to imply that everybody who has bowed legs had rickets as a kid. It may or may not be the case. But nonetheless, you know, people like that.
Yeah.
And it runs in families. You can see all of them here had vitamin D deficiencies to some extent. Okay, last things down there. Thyroid hormone is also important for developing bones during childhood. That is why they test babies at birth for proper thyroid levels. So growing up without thyroid hormone can cause a form of dwarfism called cretinism. And cretinism is also a problem in causing the nervous system to not develop either. We'll talk more about cretinism when we get into actually the first week of Bio 211. This one here on the far left has cretinism or congenital hypothyroidism. You can see it's greatly dwarfed his body. Sex hormones, we know, can also encourage bone growth. These are going to start to peak during the time of puberty. So sex hormones and puberty is what hastens the closing of the epiphyseal plate and turns it into an epiphyseal line. So at the bottom of your page down there, we'll just want to appreciate that sex hormones start to peak around the time of puberty. Let's see, exercise is important for hormones, and when bones are stressed through exercise, we will lay down extra bone tissue through appositional growth. So how does that help your bone?
Stronger
and more support, good. So that question down there, how do bones respond to stress? Well, they respond to stress through appositional growth. Okay, and it says, why is exercise necessary? And you told me you're right, to strengthen and support the bones. last question, what happens to bones that aren't stressed, such as those in a cast? What happens to the diameter?
They shrink.
They shrink, yeah. So bones that are not stressed are going to shrink in size. And if you think about it, if you wear a cast for, say, 6 weeks or 2 months, the whole point is to help you heal a fracture. Well, during that time period, your bone actually shrinks in diameter, making you more likely to fracture your bone. Yeah, so it's kind of a vicious circle there. Kind of related to bone density is this last issue called osteoporosis. If you know someone who has shrunk, and I emphasize her, that is probably a case of osteoporosis. So if you carry a little extra weight on your bones, it's actually a good thing for helping you avoid osteoporosis. Thinner framed people, here we go, Taylor. Big bones are good for this, right? Big bones help you avoid osteoporosis. If you have a thinner, more delicate frame, and if you carry less weight, then, and if you're white, you're more likely to develop osteoporosis. So if you happen to have bigger bones, if you happen to carry a little extra weight, that extra weight puts a little more force on those bones, stresses them, and we deposit more calcium to the bones in those cases. So people can lose like 5 or 6 inches of bone. It's similar to osteomalacia in that the bone is more likely to fracture, but it's not a softness issue. It's actually a porosity issue. So the bone is less dense. There's less actual trabeculae in that spongy bone tissue. All right, so bottom of your page there, the cause of osteoporosis is thinning bone. You can actually see the difference here. Thinning bone. And the populations that are affected are Caucasian and Asian populations. They more have that issue. So in the interest of time, I'm going to let you guys just read page 71. I don't think anything on there is terribly difficult to get through. It's just some information about bone fractures. Since we have about a couple of minutes left, do you have any topics that you would like me to hit one more time before the test on Wednesday?
I have a question.
Sure.
Specifically, Melissa, for the essay question,
okay.
What topics are you going to have to know for those?
I would look at the difference between a plate and an ossification center for bone growth in the lengthening process. I would look at why we're looking at tissues. Why did we study tissues? Look at that kind of as an essay. Oh, let me think what else. In the past, I've had stuff about melanoma and the ABCDE rule. So looking at the various types of burns, that's another possible thing for essays. Trying to think. That's usually, I usually hit some form of those throughout past tests. So, yeah, old tests are going to be a good guide for that too. Okay. ABCDE rule, yeah, for melanoma.
Okay.